morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Sitting across from me, Michael Cosentino.
Just as pretty as ever.
Yeah. Do you have are your earphones working? That's my question.
We are technically A-OK.
Okay.
Ready to launch.
Behind the scene, folks, we're doing video of the show, and we're trying to get all the technical stuff, and we have
Klaus von Stodaheim.
And
good morning.
We have a very distinguished guest. He's been on the show several times before, Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, runs a center, and is one of the experts on the Middle East and an incredible linguist. He's learned all these languages and stuff. He comes from a military family.
Got his PhD from the University of California.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of like my dad. He went to 12 different schools, you know, yeah. Because he got from one base to another.
How many languages do you speak, Juan?
Well, you know, you study languages for purposes, so speaking is not always one of the purposes, but I've studied 10 or 11.
Yeah. And you have a new book out, and we were going to focus a lot on Syria and wrap up and the very aggressive moves that the United States is making toward Iran. But let's talk about your book. Which is Mohammed, right? And there's a clash of empires. And give us the subtitle.
It's Mohammed, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires.
So I don't think folks know the situation in which, first, they don't know who Mohammed was. He had a tremendous experience in trade and so forth and so on. He's about 40 years old when his religious, interest began to be sparked.
Yeah, that's right. He was around that age. He had been a long distance merchant and based in Western Arabia, but would go up, according to the sources, to Jerusalem and Damascus and the Near East for trade.
So our picture of Islam, which was extremely varied, I mean, Omar Khayyam, all that sort of stuff for hundreds of years, has now been reduced. It's as if you saw Christianity only through the sort of Christian dominist extremists, the Franklin Graham, the haters and stuff. If you saw the whole religion of Christianity from its most aggressive, most extreme, and most fundamentalist part. So talk us to a little about what's in the Quran, because we were talking before air. It's very hard to find a translation of the Quran because it feels like poetry, but it's poetry with political and religious content.
That's right. I think the Quran is very badly translated. It's what Muhammad considered to be the revelations to him of God. For people who know about Christianity, I think there are some parallels between Muhammad and St. Paul, even though Paul is not a prophet, he's an apostle, but both of them, you know, had this tremendous experience, Paul on the road to Damascus, of feeling like the divine was intervening in their lives, and Muhammad in this cave near Mecca in Western Arabia felt that God was talking to him, when his mind cleared, it left behind these verses that he recited to people. And this was, as you say, he was trying to do his trade and trying to live his life and engaging in his spiritual quest at a time when war had broken out between the two great empires of the day, the Iranian Sasanian Empire in the east and the Eastern Roman Empire. What was left of the Roman Empire had moved the capital to Constantinople, and everything shifted east, and it was ruled in Greek rather than in Latin. And they dominated not only Greece and the Balkans and what is now Tunisia, what they called Africa, but also the Middle East. So they had Syria, they had Palestine, they had Egypt. And they were very influential in Western Arabia as well. So it's the context of the Quran, that these verses that Muhammad recited, is that war. It's the war between the Iranians and the Romans, and the Quran takes sides in that war. There's a verse that predicts, it mentions that the Romans have been defeated, and they were. The Iranians came into the Middle East to Syria. They took Damascus in 613. They took Jerusalem in 614, which was a huge existential crisis for Christendom. And the Quran mentions that the Romans have been defeated, but it predicts that they'll come back and that they'll ultimately be victorious. And then it says that the Roman victory will be the victory of God. So the Quran is really taking the Roman side, and I think this is generally not the way the verse has been interpreted in later Muslim times, and it's not been widely recognized by most historians in Europe and the United States either, but it seems very clear to me that the Quran is, it sees the Iranians, I think, as aggressors, and the Quran has a rule that aggressive war is forbidden, only defensive war is allowed.
You certainly got some great reviews of the book. I don't think I'll try to read them because I've got a whole list of books. But we're in a situation where people are almost gearing up for a war between the West and Islam, right? And as I said when we were talking before, when you work with Muslims, you kind of wonder what their relation is to all these extremists, because it doesn't even seem like they're in the same universe, ordinary folks. So you have a clash of empires, and I believe you've looked at the Quran in great depth and looked at it with different eyes than maybe traditional Muslim scholars have, right?
Sure. Well, I looked at it with the eyes of a historian, it's also, you know, a matter of translation to some extent, how you read the Quran. I'm reading it in the original Arabic, and I'm reading it in the context of the Greek and Persian and other works of that time. So context is everything, you know, when you're trying to interpret a text. But I think what's not been widely recognized is that the people who spoke Arabic, people who lived in eastern Syria or western Arabia, had some important customs that came into the formation of early Islam. One was that, you know, it was a tribal society, and so there was a lot of raiding and kind of poetry boasting about the raids. And but in order to have, you know, a settled life and commerce, they tried to make some exceptions, places and times when mating was not allowed. And so a shrine to a major deity would have a zone of peace around it where it was considered wrong to fight. And then there were 4 months of the year which fighting was not allowed. And I think the clan of the Prophet Muhammad, the Banu Hashim, who were based in the city of Mecca, were the custodians of the shrine to God. The Arabs were polytheists, but they did acknowledge kind of a you know, chief deity or a supreme deity, whom they just called God. And the Quran says it's the same God as the Bible. So there was this shrine in Mecca, and I think the Prophet's clan, you know, they hosted the pilgrims, they distributed food, they distributed water. But they also kept the peace, and they were mediators. And so you see this background coming out in the Quran, that the Prophet is clearly someone who tries to settle feuds, who makes rules about retribution. The Quran says that, you know, there is the Deuteronomy, a notion of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But then it goes on to say it's much better if you'll forgive the person who injured you. In that regard, it's a little bit like the New Testament. So the Prophet was a peacemaker.
So one of the reasons for the book, to be clear here, is that Islam is often seen as a violent, or at least the extremists religion. In other words, it tends to foster extremism. And this is an antidote to that. So here is here's Juan Cole, the historian, doing the research and in his book describing the predictions and the interpretations of the Quran in a much more peaceful way than many Westerners think any founding document of Islam would.
Yes, well, with regard to the later interpretation of the Quran, I think there were two big turning points. One is that Islam, like Christianity, became the religion of an empire.
Right.
And just as you have a kind of imperial interpretation of Christianity after Constantine's conversion, so you end up with an imperial interpretation of Islam. And, the Muslim Empire came into conflict with the Byzantine Empire, the successor of the Eastern Roman Empire. And so for later generations of Muslims, it was very hard to admit that the Quran had sided with the Byzantines. So they did a kind of interpretive dance to get around this obvious conclusion. And then the situation of the Prophet in Mecca was that he was preaching monotheism in a polytheistic environment, and the polytheists organized gangs to attack him, and ultimately there were some small battles between the two. From the Muslim side, I believe there were defensive battles. But these people who attacked them were called pagans in the Quran. This has been mistranslated as unbeliever. So the Quran actually says that the God of the Christians and the Jews is the same God that it worships. It says that the righteous Jews and Christians are going to heaven. When it's talking about what the translators often use, unbelievers, it's not talking about Jews and Christians. It's talking about these militant pagans who are attacking the Muslims.
Pagan Arabs, sure, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Pagan Arabs.
Yeah, they were the pagan Arabs. And so it has verses in it, like, you know, when you're being attacked, defend yourselves, fight the unbelievers wherever you encounter them. But this is mistranslated or misinterpreted as a command to fight Jews or Christians or other people, and it's not what the Quran is saying. First of all, it's a defensive situation. Second of all, we're talking about a specific group, which is the pagans.
The implication
of Mecca.
The implications of what you're saying is huge. That, especially now, with all of this sword rattling and hate is hate. You got fundamentalist Christians in the United States and in the West being schooled in the violence and one of the purposes for Islam is the downfall of Christianity, that this is some sort of inevitable showdown, and your book and your research, the implications are that it's just the opposite. It's one thing to have read a religious book and have personal revelations and implications. That's what it's all about. What your writing has international implications, and as you talk about the difference between a personal interpretation and a imperial interpretation.
I think that's the big break in Christianity. When Christianity goes from being a minority persecuted religion to an official religion of an empire, it changes fundamentally. It's a big break in Christianity. And it assumes the sort of imperial essence that we still see today. I mean, that is a major, major event in Christianity, and it really changed who Christians were, because they suddenly are the official religion that you have to believe. So you have a very different portrait of the situation in which the Quran is written. You have a fairly peaceful people whose job is to keep a sacred area safe and peaceful. And you have a man who's traveled widely in caravans all over the Middle East. He's 40 years old. He's experienced. He begins to, like Paul, have these visions and revelations from God. How does all this devolve into the kind of warlike religions, both Christianity, but we have Buddhist monks even attacking people. How does religion that's so complex and the Quran is extraordinarily hard to understand, but so nuanced, end up in such simplistic and violently focused politics?
Yeah, well, the great French student of Islam, Maxime Rodensaw, told my teacher, Nikki Keddie, one time, he said, any religion can be interpreted any way. So, you know, you have these groups now, extremists in the Muslim world, who misinterpret the Quran as a mandate for their violence. But that's not unusual. You have, you know, Jewish groups on the West Bank who do the same thing with the Hebrew Bible, and you have Christians who are Christian triumphalists and see the New Testament as a warrant for world conquest. So in all the religions, you know, extremism is a possibility, and hatred can be built on scriptures that really are about love.
But if
policymakers true in the Quran.
But what, if policymakers do read your book and they do accept the research, this has changed. I mean, this could affect change, at least in those policymakers that accept a truth outside of their political truth, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm hoping. I published it deliberately with a trade press rather than an academic one because I was hoping for a wider audience. And as you say, it's been well received. The New York Times praised it. And, you know, the French elite issued this manifesto last year this time in which they demanded that the Muslims reform themselves and that they change verses of the Quran or take them out of the book. It was the most extraordinary document. It would be like a group of Muslims demanding that the Christians take things out of the New Testament. The verses that the French elite object to are these defensive verses about, you know, defending the Muslims, defending themselves from militant pagans in Mecca. And it wouldn't be necessary to take them out. It would just be necessary to make clear that they're not encouraging contemporary violence.
There's defensive, I believe, Augustine and a whole bunch of the other early church fathers, especially as we get further down in history, advocated just wars and defensive wars for Christians, and didn't they not? I mean,
yes,
it starts fairly early.
It's one of the points I make in the book, is that if you lay the verses of the Quran about war next to those of Saint Augustine, they really don't differ. The Quran has this conception in it of just war. And by the way, the idea of just war wasn't invented by Augustine. It was he lived in the 300s and into the early 400s. But he was working from Roman theories of just war, going back to Cicero in the Roman Republic. In the first century BC. So these ideas are not new, and there's nothing, in my view, distinctive about the Quran's view of war. It's just the just war doctrine as it was believed in the Roman Empire, which was that, you know, you're always allowed to defend yourself if you're attacked. But there are other grounds for war besides just self-defense. According to Augustine, if you have a treaty with someone and they renege on the treaty and create a tort against you, that would be a grounds for going to war.
Well, going back to changing the Quran, you know, the French elites request, demand that you take verses out of the Quran. You know, the Christian Bible after Constantine was only 18 books, and and the church in its wisdom and its visions and in its speaking with the Creator, apparently, has added into what there's 67 books in a Christian Bible in 2019, depending on, once again, which religion you have, whether it's Catholicism or Protestantism. Point is, verses and passages and books come in and out of our religious documents, I don't want to say all the time, but every, I don't know, 1,000 years or so. So it while it sounds like an absurd notion, I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah. Well, actually, there's a difference we're finding between the formation of the canon of the Bible and the Quran, which is much more like, in my view, the authentic letters of Paul, in that they found these manuscripts in Yemen and to some extent in Syria and Cairo, which are very old. I mean, they're clearly first century. And it's only in the last 15 years or so that scholars have really been working on the early Quran manuscripts, looking at the script and the papyrus, and it even done some carbon 14 testing, which is inexact, you know, but it gives you probabilities. So there's a Yemen manuscript that was found that has 75% chance of being from 645 or earlier. Muhammad died in 632. So we seem to be concluding that the Quran is an early 7th century document, and that we have exemplars from the century after the prophet's death. So, and you know, there isn't anything like the earliest New Testament is about 200 years after Christ. And so the Quran is even better documented than the New Testament. You know, there had been a school of the study of early Islam in the West, which had been extremely skeptical and had thought maybe the Quran did, you know, evolve over time. There were verses that were very late in the way that the Gospels evolved over time. But this doesn't seem to be the case. And as I said, I think the better analogy for the Quran is the letters of Paul, which we think are, you know, from him and contemporaneous with him in the 50s of the first century.
Without a doubt, there's many Christians that...
And pretty exactly reproduced over and over again and spread. I mean, he almost has a clear writing style, right? So the Quran, the early versions of the Quran that they found, this is new information to me, it's pretty much it's the same document with the same same structure and the same verses, same... It's not like the Gospel of Thomas that we found as a variant on Christianity, for example.
No, it's the same book. Now, there are, you know, minor variants, but not anything to write home about so far. This manuscript material is strong evidence for the Quran having come from the prophet just as we have it now. This, as you say, it's a whole new field has grown up in the last 15 years of, you know, studying the script of the early Qurans called paleography. In addition to which, now these amateur and sometimes professional archaeologists in Saudi Arabia have been clambering around on these rock cliffs around Mecca and Medina, and they're finding that the early Muslims had a custom of writing rock inscriptions, which have survived in the hundreds, maybe thousands. And some of them contain Quran quotes, which are, you know, the quotes are not different from what we now have. And some of them are dated. The earliest one I saw, I think, was 79 years after the prophet's immigration to Medina in 622. So... the late 7th century, these are powerful witnesses for the ideas and the devotion of the very early Muslim community after Muhammad. We haven't yet found any inscriptions contemporaneous with the prophet, but that's not off the table. So this field is changing, you know, very rapidly, and new kinds of information, whether manuscripts rock inscriptions are emerging, and they're being put up on the internet so that everybody can see them and study them. What's coming out is pretty confirmatory of many of the, you know, traditional accounts of the rise of Islam.
Well, that's great, and this, once again, we're trying to what we're talking about this morning draws a clear line between, to me anyway, to the if you're a student of early Christianity and Elaine Pagels out of Princeton and all as you said, a collected New Testament didn't come around to 200 years after their prophet walked the earth, and I think the earliest manuscript they ever found was 80 years after Christ's death. And that's, as you said, carbon dating is so, and with the idea, and I guess the overarching thought here is that those writings that come closest to when these prophets, these people lived, are thus more authentic. So by finding these authentic source material for the Quran, in the proper time period, really throws a lot of weight to the authenticity of this that document.
So you knew a lot about the Quran before you started the book. What surprises once you really got into the Quran, translating, interpreting, and what surprises did you have when you started working with this very, very ancient manuscript?
Yeah, well, as you say, I had studied the Quran at the American University in Cairo in the mid-1970s, and so I've been hanging around with this book all my life. And it was the blog that got me interested in writing this book, because when after 9/11 and the Iraq War, where this kind of black legend about Islam started growing up in the United States, and it's new, you know. In the 80s, the Muslims were the good guys because they were allied with the United States against communism, and Jerry Falwell and others were praising the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But there was this sea change in attitude in the zeros in the last 10 years, and I would occasionally put up a verse of the Quran to combat this image, and my readers would argue with me because in the comment section they would say, well, that can't be in the Quran, or that can't mean what you're saying it means. And so I thought I needed to write a book.
Interesting. The blog is called Informed Comment. It is one of the most influential blogs out there. You started about 2001 to do the blog?
2002. Yeah, 2002. It was because of 9/11 that I started it.
And it became a center of people who were trying to think about this from a lot of different directions. And so it's interesting. So you when you put up the verses and had a slightly different interpretation of what the Quran was saying, that started all kind of controversies. And the controversies drove you into looking deeper into the issue.
Yes. So I decided to write it all down. And initially, I was just going to, like, go through the book because I knew it well, and I knew that there were lots of verses about peace and peacemaking. I was just going to pull them out and, you know, contextualize them a little bit, and I thought that would be a short little book about peace in the Quran. But then what had happened since I was a graduate student was that a whole field had grown up called late antiquity, and it's sort of classicists, you know, had really liked the Roman Republic, and they really sloughed off and didn't study the 500s and the 600s very much. And so there was a movement to turn to looking at the history of the early Christian Roman Empire after Constantine, 300s, 400s, 500s. And, you know, they were smart cookies, and they realized that the rise of Islam is part of this period. So there'd been this move to incorporate early Islam into late antiquity, into our understanding of the Eastern Roman Empire and its Christian basis. And so I had to get up to speed on that literature, and I knew a little bit of it, but I just read intensively in it. And then I started looking at the Quran completely differently, because it seemed to me to be kind of a Roma Akle, a kind of, set of references to that world of the Roman and Iranian war with each other, to the religious ideas of the time. And I found that these verses about peace that I had known about were much more extensive and central to the text than I had realized, and it, especially if looked at in the context of this great war, it seemed very clear that the Quran was urging an end to the war, that it's a kind of peacenik document, and that these verses about war that, you know, the Islamophobes pulled them out of context and put a string of them on the web so that they look horrible. In context, it's just Augustinian just war. It's just what they teach at Georgetown. That there's nothing distinctive or particularly violent about it. Indeed, there's an urging that nobody fight an aggressive war, that they only defend themselves. There's an urging that you make peace with people who had been your enemies. And there's something very, you know, Christ-like about it often. So I think we've been misled by the Western tradition of polemics, which, as you say, goes back to the Crusades and beyond. But also, I think the later imperial interpretation of the Quran by the Muslim, exegetes and scholars of the Muslim empires also, you know, interpreted the Quran in a martial way that's not justified by a clean reading of the text.
That's fascinating, the military interpretation of the Quran. We're going to try to grind gears here, not just change gears. I'm afraid we're going to grind them a little bit and go to the informed comment column. I just want to read to our listeners just a couple of headlines and then talk about some of these things. On your blog, there's a called informed comment. There's an article called "Hatred of One is Hatred of All," in where you discuss the San Diego synagogue shootings and that he had attempted to burn down a mosque. So this particular bad actor. It was kind of a universal hater of Muslims and Jews. There are other articles, other periodicals like Huffington Post or something. That here's another title: Trump appointee Bolton inventing a new excess of evil, including Iran, to put U.S. on war footing. So when my co-host here talks about the this build up to war that seems to be going on, I'm not sure it's going on the 11 o'clock news every night, but it certainly is for those of us that are reading other journalistic sources and seeing that what the administration seems to be trying to do.
What really I noticed was after 9/11, I noticed the buildup of the war against Iraq, and I thought they can't be doing this. They can't be attacking Iraq over 9/11. But you could feel it. You could see that. You could see them building up, and they're certainly trying to do that, aren't they? With Iran. I mean, there's assassinations and murders and killings and bombings of Iranians in Syria in somebody else's country, and I mean, it's an extremely difficult situation. But
well, they said one of the articles on the is, you know, will technology make America's forever wars permanent? I'm not sure, and certainly a lot of us on the left or even the slightly left worry about the trillions of dollars going for wars. And the upset at home and the lack of infrastructure and support at home and that forever war is permanent. Well, they certainly have seemed to be forever. Nobody seems to question anymore. Something else you don't see on the 11 o'clock news is our presence and our wars that, we're flooding so much money into.
What Syria seems to be wrapping up. It's wrapping up very different than people thought it would. Assad's still in power. We've interviewed and talked with religious minorities from Syria, and Lebanon, and it was a shock when I first talked to them and found that they actually sort of supported Assad. But now he did have genuine support, and now we've got a horribly stalemated situation where the country is divided into different forces. Does your research suggest any way to improve the situation, or I don't know, any insight into what could be done to better the situation? Should the U.S. stay in, get out? What do you think?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is not very much involved in Syria. They have a couple thousand special operations forces embedded with leftist Kurds of the northeast who are still mopping up the remnants of ISIL. That was a sideshow in the Syrian civil war, because most people in Syria live over near the Mediterranean. There's a strip of the western part of the country that the French used to call useful Syria. That's where the Damascus and Homs and the big cities are, Latakia and so forth. So by now, the regime has recovered probably something on the order of 80% of the country and 80% of the population, with Iranian and Russian help. And the Russian help was particularly in the form of massive and indiscriminate bombardment of areas held by rebels, which disregarded, you know, the fact that they were bombing civilian apartment buildings that then collapsed on families and so forth. And somehow the Russians have skated on this in world opinion, but if the United States had done a tenth of what the Russians did in Syria, it would have been a huge outcry. I don't know if people just expect Putin to be brutal or what. But it worked. Practically speaking, on the ground, Russian air power, Hezbollah and Iranian ground power, and the remnants of the Syrian Arab Army. Plus, as you say, all along, probably a majority of the Syrians stayed with the regime. There are a lot of religious minorities in Syria. 5 to 10% of the country is Christian, 14% Alawite Shiite. The Druze are 3%. You have Kurds who are mostly Sunni Muslims, but they have Yazidis and other minorities amongst them. And anyway, the Kurds have gone to a kind of post-communist leftist cooperativism. And so they're afraid of the more hardline Sunni forces, and I think the regime connived at undermining and destroying the more democratic forces on the rebel side, so that what you were left with were these seedy, devotees of what they thought of as jihad, and everybody else was scared of them. So the regime has won. There are enclaves like Idlib, and then the Kurds of the northeast. But I expect the Kurds of the Northeast to do a deal with Damascus and to be reincorporated in some way. What will happen in Idlib in the end is unknown, because it could well be that there will be a last big battle there for the regime to subject it.
Well, we're hearing all sorts of things about the millions, I guess, or at least the many refugees coming from Syria and refugees coming from Lebanon, repatriating all the Syrians in Lebanon back to Syria, I guess because, as you said, if the war is 80% over, or however over it is, does Assad want these? I haven't found any clear statement on whether these people will be welcomed back or whether Lebanon just wants to get them out of Lebanon.
Well, Lebanon certainly wants to get them out, because there are 4 million Lebanese and 800,000 Syrian refugees. So it's a big burden on the country. They have been relatively gracious, but it's a strain.
Right.
You know, this is a horrible situation, and nobody should forget that the Assad regime is genocidal. There were 22 million Syrians. 4 million of them were displaced abroad. And then on top of that, another 7 million were displaced internally. They had to run away to live with family or in tents elsewhere in the country. So this is, you know, half the population chased out of their homes, and then several hundred thousand dead. You can figure over a million wounded. It is just apocalyptic. And so you have about 2.5 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, many of whom have managed to get some kind of a job. Often it's backbreaking labor on farms, or it's, you know, poorly paid. But they you know, have some kind of an income. In places like Jordan and Lebanon, the local governments were so afraid of, you know, jobs being taken away from their citizens that they didn't let the refugees work. And in my view, that's a bad strategy. Turkey, I think, benefited from at least allowing some of them to work. And so they're just in tents, or they're in refugee camps, and their money is running out, and international aid isn't sufficient. So, of course, not only do the Lebanese want the refugees to go back, and the Jordanians are in the same position, but also the refugees themselves, you know, would love to get out of a tent. Many of them who fled violence, and so, you know, the fact that they weren't voting with their feet that they left, they're just trying to get out of the way of bombs. So many of them probably can go back, politically speaking. Whether their property still exists or whether they still own it is a big question. Others of them were ideological, you know, were opposed to the regime, and the regime is going to be very nervous about having, you know, hundreds of thousands of oppositionists come back into the country at this point. So I think there'll be some vetting going on, and I think some people will have an easier time than others. But my own experience with conflict situations, and I was in the early years of the civil war in Lebanon, is that when things calm down, people do tend to go back, and in very large numbers. So there's usually, I think, people overestimate the staying power of refugees.
So Syria.
Let me ask you a question. The million refugees that Germany took in, were those largely Syrians?
No, that's a myth. There were Syrians among the million that the Germans took in, but very large numbers of them were Pakistanis and Afghans and Somalis, you know, and Africans. With regard to the Middle Easterners, I have friends of friends who worked in refugee institutions in Europe. They said that most people can't tell the difference, right? And often a desperate Afghan or other family would claim to be Syrians because they knew that there were special facilities for them, and so there was a lot of misrepresentation. But that refugee crisis that hit Europe, and to some extent is still going on, although it's much reduced, really was diverse in its origins, and it had to do with drought, you know, in Africa and Afghanistan. And
we're talking with Juan Cole largely about his new book, and we've got about a minute left. Yeah. Why don't you tell us the title again and the publisher? And then also give us the title of your blog in the last minute of the show here.
Sure. Well, the new book is Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. It's a reinterpretation of the origins of Islam, and it's from Bold Type Books in New York, freely available everywhere books are sold, online and in your favorite bookstore. The blog is Informed Comment. It's JUANCOLE.com, and covers cultural issues as well as current events, mostly having to do with U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East.
Thanks, folks. See you next time. Democratic Perspective here.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.